Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Baby, I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Welcome to the December 2020 edition of Space Boffins, the first from our new shiny Space Boffins studio.
Woohoo!
Thank you. I was expecting wild. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientist. I'm Richard Holligham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. And joining us in the studio, which is appropriately very similar in size to a space capsule, we're thinking Mercury, is engineer and senior space systems strategist. Do you know what? Thank goodness I haven't said that after a Christmas party drink, because I can barely say it now. From Airbus Defence and Space, Liz Seward. Apart from being unpronounceable, it's a very impressive job title.
Thank you.
Does this just basically mean you're a space nerd?
Yes, definitely.
Well, later we'll be hearing about the remarkable Sew Sisters, the women who sewed the Apollo shuttle and ISS spacesuits. Also, more on Europe's latest mission to the sun, and find out what happens next.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire. Cabin pressure's holding.
Liz, we've just had the European Space Agency ESA ministerial conference. Ministers agreed future funding plans. Now, almost everything, this is quite unusual really, that the Director General Jan Werner asked for, he got. And the UK's contributed a record amount, £274 million a year. What does it mean in terms of missions?
Well, it means that we can do pretty much everything that we were hoping to do, which is fantastic. It is also, as you said, interesting because the ESA got what they want. So although we've increased our funding, so has everybody else. So our share of the work actually remains pretty similar, but we'll get to do some really cool things. I'm really excited because of the rover. So on the exploration side, the team who built the ExoMars rover are now working on the sample fetch rover. And they've been planning and working as though they're going to get the money without knowing whether it's actually going to be able to be a mission or not.
That's quite difficult, isn't it? Yeah.
So they were super relieved after the ministerial result.
And what does it mean for Airbus? Because every time we go there, and the great thing is that you're based only 5 minutes away from us, actually, down the A1, is that you're always building spacecraft. You've got your rover. You're before it's even launched, you're thinking of the next one. What does it mean in terms of Airbus perhaps building some new spacecraft in the future?
We're really pleased that we're going to stay involved in Copernicus, so that in the early phases we'll be doing the work on the ESA missions.
So that's this Earth observation program, but it's complicated by the fact that it's a European Commission, European Union Earth observation program. So there was some doubt about whether the UK would take part in that.
Yes, and in fact, we don't know if we'll take part in the later stages, but the first part is ESA only, and so that's the bit that we're going to stay involved in. And that's a really exciting bit, developing the new instruments and the new missions, and that's what will let us build a satellite in Stevenage.
I'm quite excited about the go-ahead for Orion and, you know, pushing on to the moon, and this being an international project, whatever the White House may say, this is going to become an international mission to the moon rather than just an America is great mission to the moon.
Yeah, so the ESA have money in the exploration budget so that they can be involved. And NASA know that they can't do it by themselves. It's a huge undertaking. And so they have said that they will need international partners. So in Europe, we're building the service module for Orion. And we'll be able to continue that and keep being part of the mission. And so Orion is the capsule that will take the astronauts to the moon and to lunar orbit. And then the Deep Space Gateway is the space station that will be built, and Europe will be able to provide elements of that. The UK is an expert in communications, and we are looking at providing the lunar comms so that anybody who communicates from the lunar surface will do it through British technology.
Oh, that is so cool.
And it could be. I mean, this is not beyond the bounds of possibility. It could be a British astronaut on the moon. Well, Tim Peake, basically.
Well, so one of the really exciting things is Tim Peake will have a second mission. So sometime in the 2020s, he will fly again. But yes, as to where, we don't know. Probably the International Space Station, but if we've moved on by the time he gets his flight, it could be the moon.
The other one, and, you know, because the last ministerial, they didn't get any go-ahead for an asteroid mission they desperately wanted. This time we've got this mission HERA, which is part of this joint NASA mission. So you've got this NASA mission DART, which is, the idea is to sort of try and knock an asteroid off course, and then HERA will kind of investigate it further. Is that the idea?
Yes. So the asteroid itself is really interesting. It's a binary system. So the main body is a Didymon, and has this tiny little thing around it called Didymoon, which is very cute. And so DART, the NASA mission, will hit the main body. And in doing so, they expect the little orbiting piece of rock to move and change. And so HERA will turn up, and it will be able to see what those differences are and those changes. And it's by this binary system that they'll be able to tell much more accurately, rather than if they used a sort of single orbiting asteroid. It's got some really unique technologies. It's going to do autonomous navigation around an asteroid that hasn't been done before. It is a mission that doesn't have much UK involvement. We're doing a sort of sister mission to that in the same series called Lagrange.
You say sister, some people might say rival.
I'm probably not allowed to comment. So this one is a space weather mission. It doesn't sound as sexy, but it's much more important to us here on Earth. It's going to study the sun and give us advance warning of solar activity, which can knock out power supplies and power systems and communications and disrupt banking and all sorts of things. So it will sit at the Lagrange 5 point, this point in space where you can orbit around a sort of invisible point where all the gravities balance out. The man that discovered them was Lagrange, and so this mission is named after him.
Well, last time our guest Chris Lee, the head of science at the UK Space Agency, very enthusiastic head of science, I should say, at the UK Space Agency, was raving about a new mission to the Sun, Solar Orbiter. Due for launch in February, the ESA spacecraft was built in Stevenage, a few miles away from Space Boffin's headquarters, as we like to call it. As no one calls it.
And I was going to say, it's a bit like Thunderbirds, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Very much like that. A good number of UK scientists are also involved in the mission. Fitted with 10 instruments and a heat shield capable of enduring temperatures of more than 500 degrees Celsius, Solar Orbiter will take the closest ever pictures of our star. And the mission will operate alongside NASA's Parker probe. Well, I went to see the spacecraft in Munich just before it was packed up for launch. And in the main atrium at the IABG Space Centre, I spoke to principal investigator for the magnetometer instrument, Tim Horbury from Imperial College London, and NASA deputy project scientist Holly Gilbert. I asked her first what the mission will be investigating.
The Sun actually has a large domain of influence, and we're embedded in that larger solar atmosphere, and the bubble is called the heliosphere, and this extends way beyond the orbit of Pluto even. And Solar Orbiter is going to help us understand some of the fundamental physics that goes on with all of the plasma that's being blown out by the Sun and its atmosphere.
So that's why you have to go close to the Sun to understand something, that this bubble all around the Sun.
Correct. The solar wind begins at the Sun, and a lot of the action takes place in the lower corona, or the lower solar atmosphere. So by going closer, then we can really sample the solar wind in its pristine state before it gets to Earth, where we're normally studying it. And Tim is very good at explaining this, since it's very relevant to his science.
So you're very good. No pressure.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take it back then in terms of the solar wind, because that's where you come in and understanding this magnetic influence as well of the Sun.
Right. So the magnetic field is really important to everything that the Sun does. So the Sun's really hot. So the atmosphere is up to 1,000,000 degrees. And as a result, instead of the neutral fluids that we see on the Earth, the neutral atoms, the electrons get ripped off those atoms and we end up with charged particles, protons and electrons. And those charged particles are sensitive to the magnetic field. So we have what we call a plasma, and that makes the dynamics much more complicated than anything we see on Earth. The sun's magnetic field gets really tangled up by the dynamics, the convection that's going on inside the sun. So it erupts out of the sun's surface and then controls the behavior of the particles. So we have this really complicated interplay. And it's so structured and so dynamic on so many scales. The large scales we've been able to measure before, the really big, like the North Pole versus the equator, that kind of thing. But the fine scale structures, which is what we really need to understand to look at the detailed physics of how the sun's atmosphere gets hot, and how the solar wind is actually created, how it blows away from the sun. We need to get close, because as Holly says, we need to measure that pristine solar wind as young as we can before it actually gets washed out as it travels away from the sun. The solar wind is really structured, and it kind of blurs out as you go away from the sun. So by the time it even passes the Earth, it's sort of a bit old and tired compared to what it was like when it's young and energetic near the sun itself.
Why? Is this just an understanding of if we figure this out, give us a better understanding of the whole solar system, how everything interacts?
Yes, and other stars as well. The sun is pretty much in our backyard in terms of astrophysics. When we understand how the sun is creating its atmosphere, how it's blowing it off, why it's so hot, that helps us understand things about how life was created even. It really is about studying the fundamental physics that occur not just at the sun, they also occur at the Earth and throughout the universe. But getting that fundamental understanding allows us to ultimately be able to predict space weather, which is one important component of that.
And that's the influence of the sun on the Earth and these charged particles.
Correct.
On the Earth.
Yes, it is. And even not just at Earth, but other planets. And so this is an important thing, especially for us here on Earth, because it affects our technology, our satellites, GPS, our electric grids. So it's a pretty big influence.
Now, we've just had the press conference about solar orbiters that gets shipped off to the US for launch. There was one phrase that stood out. Where they were saying the sun, it's just an average star. It's just an average star.
Okay, so
it's not that important in the grand scheme of things.
So I think the word just doesn't belong in that sentence. It's a star. And when you look up at night and you see all those stars, for so many millennia we've looked up and wondered what they are. We know what they are now, and we can study one. It's in our backyard. And I think we don't realize, when we look at the sun, it's a yellow blob. It's great, you know, it powers the life on Earth. It makes a nice, warm, sunny day. But we don't realize just how fascinating an object is. So Holly's described the importance of space weather in understanding how the sun influences our lives as we are more dependent on technology, about the sun as a prototype star for sure. We're also going to study fundamental physical processes that occur in other places around the solar system as well. So things like shocks and turbulence and so on. They're really important, for example, in around black holes, around neutron stars, accretion disks around stars, the medium between the galaxies. But I think there's something even bigger than that, which is that it's an extraordinary object. And plasmas are so fascinating in what they do. And you just have to look at some of these movies, some of the pictures of the sun, and some of the measurements that we make. It is endlessly fascinating. And I think if it was utterly unimportant to us, insignificant to us, if it wasn't like any other star, if it wasn't the same kind of physics that goes on in the universe, we'd still want to study it because it is an extraordinary object and it's in our backyard.
And it's not just Solar Orbiter that's going to be studying the sun. We've already got observatories out there now. I mean, SOHO, notably, just carrying on and carrying on and carrying on. But you launched the Parker probe. So the two will be looking at the sun at the same time?
Yes, Parker launched a little over a year ago, and there are overlapping science goals between the two missions, but the two together will really be an amazing combination, very powerful, because Solar Orbiter will be able to provide some of the context imaging. It will also be able to measure some of the same solar wind and the plasma, and so it's just kind of this wonderful combination and synergy between the two.
And you touched on this, but actually understanding the star, our nearest star, I mean, really helps us understand life and the formation of life.
It can. I mean, if we don't understand the sun, then we really are at a disadvantage in understanding how we all came to be and how the solar system formed and all of that. So it's really fundamental. And as Tim mentioned, even if it was just an average boring star, it's really incredibly sophisticated and dynamic. And that's why I got into the field. I saw images and movies of the sun And I couldn't believe how complicated it was and how dynamic. So
we can only see the sun in visible light, but imagine if you could see it in ultraviolet light with these kind of movies. And imagine if you could look up and not just see the blue sky, but see the sun like we see it from some of these ultraviolet movies, and see the solar wind in deep space. We would spend our entire lives looking up. It would just be the most spectacular view. And it's a sadness to me that we can't see it. But with spacecraft, of course, we can, and we can go and measure it. And it's an extraordinary thing. And we're going to be doing this for a long time to come, because it's just such a fascinating thing to study.
You can tell we like our jobs.
Holly Gilbert and Tim Horbury chatting to me about Solar Orbiter. Right now, the mission's being prepared for launch in Florida. It's due to blast off on the 7th of February on an Atlas V rocket. And excuse the banging in the background, they were assembling a German buffet. So there was sauerkraut, there were dumplings,
Those dumplings are heavy, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, it was enormous, absolutely enormous. Thanks very much to the UK Space Agency for supporting that feature and supporting the other features on the Space Boffins podcast.
Liz, we heard them talk about fundamental physics there, and there's a mission, LISA, that will be happening soon. LISA Pathfinder, it will follow on from that, which was all about testing the technology for detecting gravitational waves. So does the recent ministerial mean, pretty sure, we've got LISA, all systems go?
Yes, it does. LISA mission is now in the planning. It'll launch in the 2030s. It's three satellites flying in formation 5 million kilometres apart behind the Earth. They sort of trail in the heliocentric orbit, so it goes around the sun. And there are test masses inside each satellite, which are golden platinum balls. And they are connected by laser beams.
I thought they were cubes, actually.
Cubes, they are cubes. You're
right, thanks.
And they're connected by laser beams, and the laser beam can measure picometer differences in their movements.
Is that 10 to the minus 9, is it?
Yes, so I'll go with that.
We'll go
minus
with that.
12?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, maybe it's minus 12. Oh, Pico,
I've forgotten that.
Me too.
Answers on a postcard,
yes,
please.
And so these very...
No,
very...
nano's 9, isn't it? No, this is really good. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is minus 10. I've got really interested in this.
We'll look it up in a second. We'll come back to it.
So the spacecraft will be able to measure these minute movements that will happen when a gravity wave passes through the spacecraft constellation. And the reason that you have three of them is so that you can triangulate the position. So that our optical telescopes can look at something, and then LISA, which is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna,
well done,
can detect where this can then pick up a gravity wave, and we can work out where it's come from. And
Pico is 1 times 10 to the minus 12.
Funnily enough, as you started, I thought, no, it's 12. It's 12. Oh, well done. Well done, Liz.
I'm celebrating.
And I sort of remember that while LISA Pathfinder was doing its mission, there was actually proof of gravitational waves, but in a ground-based detector, which could have stolen the mission's thunder, really, which could have made them think, well, we don't need to go into space now, because we've got a system that works down here. But I thought it was a very good sort of response that I read at the time, which was that, well, actually, that's detected on the ground, but we need to detect gravitational waves in space.
And we need it more than ever, because the system on the ground is limited by the distance that you can dig a tunnel in an area that doesn't have any outside influences and vibration, so no lorries driving over it. And what it means is it detects only very high frequency gravity waves because of the shorter baseline, whereas LISA will be enormous and it will detect the really big gravity waves. So it's perfect, in fact. The timing was fantastic to show that they do exist. Einstein was right, because it all comes from Einstein's theory of general relativity. And LISA will give us this fundamental physics view of the universe that hasn't existed. Somebody I talked to said it's a bit like when they discovered the infrared. It's a whole new area that we'll be able to observe things in, to teach us things that we don't yet know that we don't know.
You're listening to Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and even email, mail, you know, whiteboards, whatever. info@boffinmedia.co.uk.
I think we should encourage post, but I can never remember what our address is, so let's not.
No, no.
What I really want to mention is Sue's book, Wally Funk's Race for Space. The fabulous Wally Funk's Race for Space. Good stocking filler at Christmas.
Right, yes. By now, our
stocks on, are. Yeah, is in an Adidas advert.
I know. That was a complete surprise. I just purely found out because I was tagged on a tweet.
This is an Instagram.
It was an Instagram. Yeah. That's right. Adidas London. And it's a woman called Eleanor Frost from UCL who works within space and medicine. And she wants to be an astronaut. Who doesn't? But unlike me, she's obviously a good runner. And so it's an ad talking about her ambitions, space, and it looks like she's in her room. And you see lovely little space artifacts and stuff behind memorabilia and what have you behind her. And then they show a bookshelf, and there is Wally Funk's Race for Space. And I was so thrilled. And I wouldn't have known. I think it was Dallas Campbell, actually, who said, yay, there's Wally Funk's Race for Space. So, Eleanor, thank you. Thank you.
You are reaching new audiences.
Yeah, that's so cool. But I keep saying cool today, don't I? But it is. It's very cool.
You're down with the kids.
Yes. Yeah,
no, really. That's old-fashioned now.
No one says that. While we're on the housekeeping, we'll come back to the jingle competition. We'll do that in January. More excitingly, the Doctor Who magazine competition. So this is Doctor Who annual. We went to this junk shop in Birmingham, which was just fantastic. And I bought this whole selection, because they were there, of almost mint condition Doctor Who annuals, and this was from 1978. I put this on Facebook, which is probably, you know, breaking some sort of BBC, you know, rule or something. In a Spot the Difference competition with the Doctor, obviously the Doctor, Tom Baker, in the TARDIS. I could only spot four differences, but there are apparently five differences. Also pointed out, it says, because I was really flummoxed by this, I thought, I'm never going to find five. It says right at the bottom, check your answers on page 60.
Yeah,
I just didn't spot
you've
that at
failed
all.
The intelligence test there, but I must admit, I always like those Spot the Difference things in annuals. I think there's a big... they should bring annuals. Well, they do still have annuals,
so you can still
don't
get a
they?
Beano annual, I think
they need to do some sort of spacey annual.
When is the Boffin annual
coming? Space Boffin's Christmas annual.
Yes, they could be a limited edition. We could just make them ourselves. Yeah, we could do a Spot the Difference, couldn't we? You know?
That would be great, wouldn't it?
We can give you some great imagery for that.
Absolutely, we'll be at Airbus. We'll be in that clean room, moving a few things around. Taking a little instrument off a spacecraft just to spot the difference. No, okay, maybe not.
What, to a before and after?
Yeah, that needs a little bit of thought, doesn't it? Thinks about it. Well, as you probably... Richard. I'm so pleased. That is so fun. That's because you were checking.
Up on the mixer as well. It's because
you were checking picometer, yeah, weren't you? That's so funny. And you know what you've just reminded me of? In over the summer, I made a program. Just mentioned Dallas Campbell, actually. I made a Radio 4 program with Dallas called Moonbase 2027. And we were at Cologne at the ESA Astronaut Training Centre. And we were doing an interview with Tim Peake, and we were in that mock-up of the International Space Station. And halfway through the interview, my phone went off. But my phone is more a sort of, you know, bring, 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 bring. And I'll have to find, actually, the outtake and play it for you, because we've got Tim Peake and Dallas just going, oh, Sue, that's so unprofessional, Sue. So I'm so glad. It's not just me now.
My defence, it was to look up picometers.
Yes, oh, good grief. Right, well, let's go back to what I was about to say. You definitely know from that both of us make radio programmes. And I've got one coming up that space fans are definitely going to like. It's called Hey Sisters, So Sisters. The title, it's all in the title. It's on BBC World Service on New Year's Eve, and it's about the women sewers on space missions from the moon landings to the present day. America's Apollo astronauts needed space suits, of course, and they were made at ILC Dover in Delaware. And I was there recently for the programme with the presenter, who is astronaut Nicole Stott. Hi, Nicole. And I met there Bill Airy, who managed the test lab there for 40 years and is also the company historian. Well, here's what Bill had to say about the seamstresses to the stars.
They were the one employee in the company that walked out at the end of the day having produced something. And that something was the spacesuit. When Neil Armstrong, for instance, set foot on the moon, what you saw was a spacesuit on the moon. So those sewers, the ladies that did it, could really take the pride in what they did because there it was. There was their work on the moon. The draftsmen, all the people that supported it, certainly had that pleasure and excitement too because they played a critical role. But the sewers, it was their work you'd see front and center.
Well, Jean Wilson was one of those seamstresses. Now in her early 70s, she joined ILC Dover at 19 years old and became head sewer, working on the Apollo spacesuits.
Well, all of it was delicate. But the thing is that it was very technical for everything that you had to do. You didn't take for granted, like, oh, this is a piece of cake, I can do, you know. So it was like everything. You had to really be very careful and be very delicate. Most of what I did, helping to put the suit together, was the sleeves, the torso area, the legs, all of that. There was ladies and seamstresses that mainly dealt with the gloves. And then there were some that did the boots. And I know there was one young lady. She has since, I think, passed away. But she made a set of boots. And every time they were inspected, everything went through. Everything was good, good, good. Everything was perfect. So she actually made a perfect pair of boots that had absolutely nothing wrong with them.
How much was hand-sewn and how much was machine-sewn on the suit?
Mostly everything was basically machine, was done by machine. Some things were glued or a certain way. It was sealed a certain way, but it was mostly sewn by machine. There were things like snaps and different things like that that were put on the suits. They were done by special equipment that we had.
And the American flag and the name patch, did you sew those?
Yes, in? I remember I remember having those had to be sewed on. Like Alden or someone or some of the other astronauts, Armstrong sewing the name on. And putting it on, it had to go on a certain way, using the certain type of thread that we had. So at 19 years old, I had to give orders and instructions to women that were in their 40s and 50s. And in 1969, during that time, you're talking about, and being a female and the fact that I was also, they called me the colored girl because of the fact that I was so young. Even though there was a difference with some of them because they were dealing with the fact of having to take orders from someone and then the fact of the color of my skin and everything else, it did cause some issues, but not very long because within a week's time, I was very patient, and I could tell some of them didn't want to do what they were told, but you got to remember how important their jobs were.
How do you feel now about your work and about the fact that you are a part of space history?
I've always felt that I did something that was important, and I'm really proud of the fact, you know, that I remembered what my mother told me and taught me, and I listened to her because a lot of my friends, when I was coming up in school, had home economics classes and all that, but they didn't listen. They didn't care and they didn't listen. But I took a lot of pride in what I did then. And now I'm learning from my family. Now that it's all coming out, what happened in 1969, they're celebrating it now 50 years later. I have brothers and a sister that's still living. And I have other family members, nieces and nephews and different ones that in my family, besides some of my neighbors and friends and all, are finding out. Said, boy, you're like a celebrity. You know, boy, that's really special what you did, you know. And to find out more about the history of different things that happened. And it's quite rewarding. But I feel so special. That's why I brought along a picture of my mother to show you. I said, because of her teaching me how to sew, then I was able to advance on and to go into working the way I did on the Apollo spacesuits. And that helped me to go a step farther and to have my own business and getting more into designs and all that.
The basic premise of a spacesuit hasn't changed as far as the soft goods. The parts of the suits that are sewn together still require the sewers to be able to sew these parts together and make it work. Seams have to be within a 16th of an inch, sometimes even tighter tolerances, and they have to hold up to the strengths, and it has to be repeated over and over again. It has to be done the same way so the quality's the same and it's consistent. The reliability is built into it. So we still depend very, very much on these sowers and the work they do. Now, these space shuttle suits have now evolved into the space station suits, the International Space Station, when we retired the space shuttle. Essentially, the same suits are being used with some modifications on board the International Space Station. So, again, life critical. If an astronaut goes out and does a spacewalk and their spacesuit fails, their life is in our hands, essentially, and the suits have to hold up to the rigors of a 6 hour or seven or maybe close to 8 hour spacewalk.
Well, it wasn't just spacesuits. The space shuttle required a surprisingly large amount of sewing, from the tile gap fillers, which were made of fabric, to thermal blankets inside the bulkhead, on the side of the vehicle, and also on the orbital manoeuvring system, the two big engines on the back beside the three main shuttle engines. Well, the lovely Sew Sister, Jean Wright, is a NASA volunteer or docent at the Kennedy Space Center. But during the shuttle era, she was an aerospace composite technician for NASA's soft goods.
The composition of them, and it'll surprise you, because the fabric is literally made out of quartz stone. The thread is quartz. The layering, and we had different thicknesses that we stacked depending on the class of the blanket, was spun quartz. And the backing fabric that would actually glue to the shuttle itself is just plain old fiberglass. Mm-hmm. It's pretty basic. So the main question I get asked all the time as a docent is, how in the world do you make thread and fabric out of quartz? And I asked one of my engineers that day, his name's Tim Wright, and he said to me, have you ever seen cotton candy being made? And I said, well, sure. And he goes, just imagine powdered quartz. And we literally put it in a machine where it melts it to a liquid. And then from there, it's made almost like cotton candy. He goes, we get that little spinneret of thread, and then consequently we can weave it into a fabric. So that's surprising to people.
What's also surprising is the machine that Jean used to sew these thermal blankets, which were rated for temperatures up to 650 degrees Fahrenheit or more. And some of them had names. All of them had names, in fact. One of them was called Lurch, but not this one.
It's a multi-needle machine, and it's 10 feet tall, and it looks like a weaving loom. It's got 30 needles that are about 9 inches long, and 2 inches are up into the machine. It's got a trough of WD-40 that holds about 1 or 2 gallons, maybe upwards of 3. And as a seamstress, it's really tough because we would have a spray bottle of WD-40, and as the blanket's going through being quilted, you have to spray fabric with oil, and that to me is just, it's shocking. Yeah. After that, we know the blanket's going to fit. People are unaware of, we bake the blankets. We have ovens downstairs. It looks like pizza ovens, and the blankets will be baked in two steps at 650 degrees for 4 hours. Then it gets bumped up to 850 for two more, and it literally turns beige and off-white fabric to, it looks like white silk when we take it out of the oven. Then it will get its room temperature vulcanization, or the RTV glue, gets glued right onto the shuttle skin. We'll get a clear coat of ceramic paint called C9, and then 4 hours later, a white hard coat will go on, which is why people ask me all the time, it can't be the real shuttle because she looks like paper mache. But we did a lot of things, a lot more hand sewing than people think, because all 2,200 blankets, we have to knot the intersection where the threads meet, flip the fabric to the back, and every one of those are stitched by hand. We also did thermal barriers. They're about 4 feet long and would take us 4 days apiece to do by hand. Those are installed in all the wheel wells, and we ladies, after the thermal barriers are done, we hand sew those into place. And on average, it would take 17 hours for two of us to sew all 12 of them into one wheel well, and they're only rated roughly for 3 flights.
The glorious Jean Wright, a wonderful woman, and just a taster of her and the other seamstresses that appear in Hey Sisters, Sew Sisters, which will be broadcast on BBC World Service on December the 31st and will be available on the BBC website or the Sounds app after that.
Liz Seward's still with us from Airbus.
You think she'd run off?
Yeah, well, no, she's still here. She can't get out of the studio since tomorrow.
Locked it. Yeah.
The beautiful, wonderful studio.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, last time I interviewed you, Liz, it was in the overlooking the Mars rover room as the Mars. Oh, actually, I mean, it was amazing. And we were watching the Mars rover being assembled. We just happened to be very lucky that they were sort of moving things around, the ExoMars rover at Airbus. And then you were demonstrating how clean you had to be to go into the clean room. And one aspect of that was putting gloves on. And we put that on Space Boffins. I think it's in the September edition of Space Boffins. And everyone laughed at me because I couldn't put on a pair of gloves. It's really hard. So we've asked you to bring some gloves for our special Christmas edition. We are going to put gloves on
right,
a podcast.
We'll see. Oh, I'm a bit sweaty actually. So this can I go and get my talcum powder?
So this is the sort of thing that wins Space Boffins awards. Putting gloves on. Okay.
And I have to admit, so your struggles were partly my fault because we had a very small pair of gloves. So this time I've asked for large gloves.
Oh, excellent.
And I have one for everybody.
Thank you.
Here is your glove. So they're
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thank you. Sterile
gloves. Okay, so what do we do?
So they're in the packet. So you would peel the packets open, and if you were you'd be very careful about what you put down.
So we mustn't touch the outside of the gloves, presumably.
No. So there's certain bits you can touch. So it comes in this folded piece of plastic.
Oh,
so you can take it out.
Take it out, okay.
And then
this is plastic within plastic. So the gloves, okay, so these are the gloves now within a folded plastic. Mm-hmm. And they're already set, so you've already got the sort of folded over, so you can already got the inside slightly on the outside at the bottom part of the glove, if I'm describing that correctly.
Basically, the inside of the glove is allowed to be dirty because that will touch your skin. The outside must be sterile. You may only touch the outside of the cuff. You can't tuck your fingers in because then you're touching the sterile side.
Okay, so I can put my fingers in the glove.
Ah, right. Okay.
And I can touch the inside with the other hand, can't I?
Yes, you can touch the folded cuff.
Hey, I'm doing this.
You can't touch the outside.
I'm doing it. Right, so I've got the glove on.
So the first one looks like putting on the tightest pair of marigolds ever.
But you can't touch the outside, so you'd have actually failed.
The outside with this.
No, yes, so you can touch the inside with your dirty hand, but the outside you can only touch with your clean, sterile glove.
So I can put the outside, clean glove on the outside bit.
And in fact, the cuff is designed so that you can slot your clean fingers inside the cuff like this. Here's what I'm demonstrating. So that it gives you a handhold so that you can then slide your hand in.
See, one glove is relatively easy. It's the second glove that's... You've done it.
I've got mine on.
I've got one.
Apparently, I've failed.
So like, if you basically, if the glove is like that,
hold on. I'm trying the second one on. This time, I'm determined not to fail.
No. But you're touching the inside.
I'm
of the
not.
Glove.
I'm with the clean.
Yes.
You have to tuck your fingers in like that.
So you failed.
You have to take the cuff and tuck all four of your sterile fingers, but turn it round like this.
Okay.
So I've got them on.
And then that forms your handhold to hold tight.
Okay. And then I can put the other glove on.
Put the other glove on. Okay, try again. Twist.
Excellent.
Okay, so, we'll struggle with this. Now, at the beginning of the podcast, I can't believe now I've got these gloves on. At the beginning of the podcast, we played you a clip from the Apollo 10 mission. Apollo 10 is often called the dress rehearsal for the moon landing. Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan flew the lunar lander known as Snoopy within just 47,000 feet of the moon's surface. After a dramatic flight, which we've talked about before on the podcast, they returned to the Charlie Brown mothership to rejoin their crewmate John Young. And then they separated from Snoopy.
Okay, Houston, we'll give you a countdown. We're all set to go for SEP, right?
That's affirmative. Charlie Brown, we're standing by for your count.
The idea was to send it towards the sun.
Give you a five count. 4, 3, 2, 1, fire. Cabin pressure's holding. Snoop went someplace.
Dan, when he leaves. Yeah, okay, don't back into that dude now, John, when you get turned around. Are you keeping it in sight?
Yeah, okay. Joe, he took off so fast, he's gone. He went right into the sun.
Or at least that's what they thought. It turns out that Snoopy, the Apollo 10 LEM, is still out there, in orbit, around the sun. Engineer, educator and Apollo enthusiast Nick Howes has been leading efforts to track it down.
Apollo 10 was the first time they'd obviously gone to the moon to do a full dress rehearsal. And what happened with all the other subsequent lunar modules, apart from Apollo 13, which was used as a lifeboat to get the crew back to Earth, which is now at the bottom of the Tonga Trench at 30,000 feet or whatever. But all of the others were crashed into the lunar surface for assistance with the seismic experiment. With Apollo 10, once they completed their kind of fly above the lunar surface, they reconnected back with the command module, Charlie Brown, which is in the Science Museum, and then basically fired off the lunar module into what's called a heliocentric orbit, which is what the Earth is doing. So it kind of goes around the sun. So it was fired with sufficient burn. So the engine's burn. It's called a delta V burn. So it's basically velocity and trajectory. So it's basically where it goes in space. And talking to Gene Cernan a few years ago, before he sadly passed away, he said, oh, yeah, we chucked it into the sun. And some of the modelling we did showed that it was actually thrown in a sunward direction. It was tracked then for several hours after that by mission control and the ground telemetry team looking at the data, burned to depletion, so effectively to get rid of all the fuel. But what was interesting, some of the data we got back showed that the velocity that it separated was kind of not what they expected, and it was because there was an issue with the hatch and it kind of depressurized. So essentially the cabin had depressurized and it's just flown off into this heliocentric orbit.
So because the cabin had depressurized, that gave it, what, some extra thrust?
A bit of extra kick, yeah. So some of this data wasn't really in the public domain. So as I said, a few years ago, I kind of set up a project to hunt for Snoopy based upon the success we'd had with the Folkes telescopes of finding asteroids with some young people. And the idea was to really engage kids in science and discovery and trying to find things of interest. And at the time, I was kind of told it was almost impossible. The odds were hundreds of million to one kind of thing.
Well, think of the size of that. I mean, it's not much bigger than a wardrobe. It's not much bigger than a wardrobe when they've headed off towards the sun. I mean, you're talking big distances.
Yeah, you're looking at a 900 million kilometre orbit with a 4.5 metre wide spacecraft and no accurate data on it since 1969. We had basic what's called ephemeris, so the position, like a sat nav, its position in space from 1969, but that was it. So what we then did was we looked at the best known accurate tracking data. And a guy called Mike Laux, who is an astrodynamics expert, worked on the LADEE mission, for example, on the moon. He helped enormously using some modelling software to model potentially where it could be. So we came up with a few solutions of various orbits. And then early last year, I kind of got a heads up from a friend who works at Catalina Sky Survey saying we've got a new object that's kind of, you may want to look at this. So we looked at the data on that, and the object was called 2018 AV2. And the name comes from its time of year when it's discovered. So AV2 is basically January, early January object. So we looked at this object and immediately the size was right and the orbit seemed to match the data models that we put together, and it was kind of that. And then we were looking at some of the radar data from it as well, and the radar data was all over the place and it was very weird, not a typical asteroidal kind of radar profile. And we kind of looked through the data extensively, thinking, well, possibly. And then another team at JPL, led by Paul Chodas, he'd commented as well via kind of set of private messages saying, "This, we really believe this could be Snoopy." So after lots of thought and lots of kind of remodeling, and Mike's still working on some new models, etc., we're about 99% convinced that it is Snoopy. The problem we've now got is at Mach 29.7, so there's literally no telescope on Earth that can now see it. And its orbit, basically, it's in this weird convoluted looping orbit that we predicted. So the orbits match. It's a really good match. Unfortunately, it's not coming back into our neck of the woods until about 2037. So we've been talking to people on the SLS project, because Artemis 1, Artemis 2 obviously are going translunar. And they've said, look, if you can get enough funds together for a 12-unit CubeSat mission, and stick some cameras and possibly LiDAR on it, etc., reasonable resolution cameras, you could get a flyby. And we worked out the burn times to get, and this velocity delta V thing to get there. And it's about 105 days. We could do an intercept of where Snoopy is with a CubeSat and image it up close to prove conclusively that it is.
So hang on. this would be one of the new SLS, so the first of these new giant rockets. Yeah. Goes out around the moon.
Yeah.
It's going to launch quite a few spacecraft,
yeah,
not people,
yeah,
in that mission. And one of those could be a CubeSat that will go and spot the Apollo 10 lunar lander. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it?
It's amazing. As I said, it's down to the funding, and I'm in two minds over this, because it's not really a vanity project, but it's kind of like, where's the scientific return from this? So we're looking at what we could do in terms of other side missions with the same small CubeSat spacecraft and just use Snoopy as a kind of target of interest within the confines of that mission. But yeah, it's amazing that EM2, we've actually had conversations with them and they've said, you know, this could be a viable option as one of the missions.
So this is really space archaeology, isn't it? I mean, this would be true space archaeology, going to find a 50-year-old object that's out on this weird orbit around the sun.
Absolutely. It's weird because, as I said, the only other remnant from that kind of era from the LEMs is to currently sit. It's the RTG from Apollo 13, which was designed to kind of...
Sorry, RTG.
So the radiation thermogenerator, basically the power supply, was designed to kind of survive re-entry because it's a nuclear power source. So essentially that and bits of Apollo 13 are stuck at the bottom of the Pacific Trench, one of the deepest places on Earth. So that's one thing you could possibly go out and find and have a bit of fun with. But until we go back to the surface of the moon, and they're talking about obviously protecting the original Apollo sites, so getting near those is going to be incredibly difficult. This is one of the really most interesting, I'd say, archaeological artefacts from any space era.
Astronomer Nick Howes, who tweets as Nick Astronomer. Isn't that a remarkable story?
It is. And a lovely sort of bonus of going back to the moon.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fantastic to do that? So I hope they get it together to be able to do that mission. What's even more incredible, at the moment still, Tom Stafford, who commanded that spacecraft, is still alive. Gene Cernan and John Young, sadly, no longer with us. But, wouldn't that be fantastic if he saw his spacecraft again?
That is amazing. And it definitely beats Tesla hands down as the coolest man-made object and the first man-made vehicle to be in orbit around our solar system.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right, yeah.
Well, thank you very much to our guest, Liz Seward from Airbus Defence and Space, for joining us in our new studio and also for bringing some rubberware. We got a little bit more pleasure out of those gloves than is seemly, I feel.
We'll put the pictures up on Facebook, if they'll let us. You just wanted to mention one more mission, I think, Liz.
So there's a mission that has, the study phase has been funded through the ESA ministerial, called TRUTHS. And in fact, the acronyms in Sue's sewing ladies reminded me of it. It's the acronym stands for the Traceable Radiometry Underpinning Terrestrial and Helio Studies.
Oh, I hate these acronyms.
Wow.
These acronyms drive me mad.
So in an era of fake news, we're sending out, TRUTHS.
TRUTHS. And what it will do is, it's a brand new hyperspectral instrument to study climate change. So it's actually very down to earth, but it does have an amazing acronym.
Brilliant. Liz, thanks again.
And thank you for listening. Do tell people about Space Boffins. We'd love your feedback, as long as it's nice. So say nice things on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. We are supported by the UK Space Agency. We're very grateful to them. And let's end with a Christmas message from Gemini 6, in orbit above the Earth alongside Gemini 7 in 1965. And we'll see you in January.
You're too much, Six.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.